My guest at this time is David Keene, formerly the chairman of the American Conservative Union and president of the National Rifle Association. He is now opinion editor at the Washington Times, and he is co-author of Shall Not Be Infringed, The New Assaults on Your Second Amendment. And David, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure to be with you.
I want to get your reaction, first of all, to the confirmation and now swearing in of Associate Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. Obviously, a lot of back and forth between the two parties about how Merrick Garland was handled and now how the Democrats treated Gorsuch and so forth. But in the end, when it comes to the Second Amendment, what does it mean that it's Gorsuch on the court and not Garland?
Well, if Garland had won confirmation, that would have reversed the majority favoring the Second Amendment as defined by the founders and as ratified in the Heller decision by the Supreme Court some years ago as an individual right in this country to keep and bear arms. So preventing the Garland confirmation and replacing Antonin Scalia with Justice Gorsuch is a tremendous victory for America's gun owners, for believers in freedom, and for the Second Amendment. I think that Mitch McConnell in the Senate deserves a great deal of credit for standing up to the Obama administration's essentially a Hail Mary pass to reverse the majority on the Supreme Court in the final days of that administration, and for delivering on his promise to make sure that Judge Gorsuch would be, in fact, confirmed to the Supreme Court. So that's a tremendous victory. It does not, however, mean that gun owners can be comfortable in terms of what might happen during the course of the next year or so at the Supreme Court level, because it simply reestablishes the majority that existed with Scalia on the court, a very shaky majority that might not hold if some cases involving severe restrictions on the Second Amendment make it to the court before another justice is appointed.
Quick follow-up, David. How big of an issue, and ultimately everybody thinks their issue is the one that made the difference, especially in a close election, but given the stark difference between Trump and Hillary Clinton on guns, Hillary Clinton mentioning at one point in a debate that the Heller decision was about toddlers, or the fact that the Supreme Court seat was open at that point, and obviously the Second Amendment was one of the issues that was going to be impacted by whoever filled that seat, how big of an issue ultimately do you think it was in 2016?
It was an incredibly important issue. Both the Second Amendment itself and the Supreme Court. 56% of those voters who identified the future of the Supreme Court as important to them voted for Donald Trump. The NRA endorsed Donald Trump very early once he committed to appointing a justice that would fill the Scalia shoes with the same view of the Constitution that Scalia held. And if you look at the outcome of the election, look at where the votes change, who it was that voted for Donald Trump that had been voting Democratic in previous elections, you find that it's in small towns, rural areas, particularly in the Midwest, in western Pennsylvania, in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Iowa. These are people who care deeply about the Second Amendment. All you have to do is, for example, go to West Virginia, where you had two issues, coal and guns, and you had over 70% of the people vote for Donald Trump. The vote in the areas that made a difference was up both in terms of turnout and in terms of the choice that the voters had to make because of the Supreme Court, because of the Second Amendment.
You mentioned that there are court fights to come, and of course that's true. There's also political fights to come, perhaps not as many with Republicans in the White House and controlling the House and Senate right now. But you also point out in the book that a lot of people in 2008 weren't too worried about what might happen to their guns if this senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, were to be elected. You and your wife, I believe, were out in Montana, and they were laughing at your concerns that Second Amendment might be infringed to some extent if he were to be elected. So for those who are concerned about this issue, how did Obama frame the issue that made people believe that he would not be a threat to their guns, and how do you vet people in the future?
Well, in 2012, President Obama's campaign actually ran ads in some of these areas. And remember, he was busily nationalizing the healthcare system and doing some other things from 2008 to 2012. That didn't allow him to get down far enough on his agenda to go after the Second Amendment. But in 2012, his campaign actually ran ads to try and suppress the pro-Second Amendment vote, in which he famously said, "I will not take your shotgun, I will not take your pistol, I will not take your rifle. I'm a believer in the Second Amendment." We predicted at the NRA at the time that if he was reelected, he would in fact go after the Second Amendment based on a lifetime of opposition to gun rights. And of course, given the catalyst and the excuse of the Sandy Hook tragedy, he went after the Second Amendment big time once he was reelected.
Yeah, that was just about a month after he was reelected. David, whenever the debate flares up, especially politically, we hear terms like common sense gun control or universal background checks, the Manchin-Toomey legislation, which you refer to in the book, that ultimately did not pass the cloture vote and so forth. So you also point out that the media is not exactly objective on this issue. So for folks who don't have the ability to follow it day to day because they have lives to live, what's the best way to parse through all this kind of stuff?
Well, there's several things you can do. One, of course, as my wife suggests, you can buy my book, which will give you, I think, a fairly good, at least introductory briefing and overview of the kinds of threats that believers in the Second Amendment face and the motivation of those who are so opposed to firearms ownership in this country and abroad. It's almost a religion. John Bolton, in the foreword to the book, makes the point that they remind him of the unilateral disarmament crowd of the 60s and 70s. You remember those folks who said that if the United States just destroyed all of its weapons, that the world would be a utopian place because other countries wouldn't need weapons either and we'd all live in peace. Fortunately, that idea did not take hold and was not executed. But there are folks who believe essentially the same thing in terms of private gun ownership. They actually believe that if they could snap their fingers and if firearms would disappear, there'd no longer be burglaries, there'd no longer be robberies, we'd all live in peace, and I assume unicorns would dance across the horizon. And it's almost a religious fervor with which they go after firearms ownership. But it's important to understand that motivation, because if you understand it, you realize that these are not folks that are going to give up. They're folks that are going to find other ways to fight the battles that they haven't won in the legislature, that they haven't won in the courts. They're using international treaties to do it. The Bloomberg Axis, the former mayor of New York, who's devoted hundreds of millions of dollars to his gun control schemes, is trying to pursue his goals through referenda in local areas and in states where he thinks he might be able to muster a majority of voters. So there are a lot of things that are going to happen and are going to continue to happen. And like most freedoms, this is a freedom that if you don't stand up for it and if you aren't willing to defend it and if you're not vigilant, is liable to disappear on you.
We're talking with David Keene. The book is Shall Not Be Infringed. David is the opinion editor at the Washington Times. And David, in our last couple of minutes here, just a couple more questions. And I definitely want to get to one of the key premises of your book in just a moment. But another interesting passage in the book details an exchange between Senator Lindsey Graham and FBI Director James Comey, which makes me ask the question, how much does the government really understand? How much do lawmakers really understand the facts when it comes to firearms? Because in that exchange, the FBI director just thought that if there's a gun purchase over the internet, that the buyer gets it in the mail from the seller. And as you point out in the book, that's not what happens at all. So
that's exactly right. I mean, it's one wonders how much our government officials know about any of the laws they're supposed to execute. But certainly the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is very, very integral to the enforcement of our gun laws, and which oversees the database that's checked to see if one is able or not able to purchase a gun, you would think that the director of the FBI would have some smidgen of knowledge as to what happens if one buys a gun in another jurisdiction. Of course, nobody can mail you a gun that you purchase from another state over the internet or anyway. It has to go from one federal firearms licensee to another. And that's been the law for many, many years. And one wonders, I was frankly, when I witnessed the exchange between Senator Graham and the FBI director, I was flabbergasted because one would have expected him to know what every gun dealer, what every gun owner, what what virtually every prospective purchaser of a firearm already knows.
Last topic, and it's kind of a big one because it takes up a lot of the book, and it's a threat that you believe might be one of the biggest to the Second Amendment, regardless of who's in the White House, although that can certainly make a big difference on the issue. And that's the United Nations Small Arms Treaty. It's one that the Obama administration signed on to eventually with Secretary of State John Kerry. Explain for our listeners what it imposes on American gun owners and what they should be concerned about.
Well, it was passed. It was sent in the final weeks of the Obama administration to the Senate, where it will not be ratified, not at any time in the near future, because there is a majority, a bipartisan majority of the Senate that would vote against ratification. But even if it's not ratified, under international law, a nation is supposedly prohibited from acting contrary to the spirit and letter of a treaty, even though it has not been ratified through processes within the country itself. This is in the way that the Obama administration used the Kyoto Treaty, which was the global warming treaty that was never even sent to the Senate, to justify legislation and regulatory acts that the administration took. So I believe firmly that since a treaty lives forever, and since it does in fact impose requirements that you can obviously object to or you can obviously reject or act differently than, that it really needs to be killed. There are two ways to do that. One, the President of the United States has the authority to withdraw this nation's signature from the treaty. And I think and I hope that President Trump will consider doing that. The other way to handle it is for the Senate to bring it up and put a stake through its heart and just reject it. Otherwise, it sits there. Treaties have eternal life. The Senate every once in a while is being urged to ratify, for example, the Law of the Sea Treaty, which was negotiated in the 60s and early 70s and is still there and has to be fought year in and year out because it has virtually eternal life.
And real quickly, what would the Small Arms Treaty do if, in fact, it were to be enacted?
Thing is, well, one thing is that it would prohibit signatory countries from shipping arms to human rights violators. In the United Nations Human Rights Commission, the private ownership of firearms, the allowing of the private ownership of firearms, is in itself a human rights violation. And therefore, it is at least theoretically possible that those in charge of the treaty could urge countries that produce firearms and many of the sporting arms as well as self-defense arms that are purchased in this country are, after all, manufactured in other countries, that that they could require that those countries stop shipping to the United States because we allow private citizens to own firearms. The treaty also has standards. And it's interesting because the things that the treaty authors want are very similar to what Barack Obama proposed in the form of his common sense regulations. They want bans on so-called assault weapons that are, in fact, semi-automatic rather than real assault weapons. They want limits on magazines. They want all of the things that Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Schumer and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton wanted here. In many ways, that treaty is simply an attempt by anti-firearms ownership folks to go around domestic politics and domestic constitutional guarantees to try and find some way to achieve their ends via treaties rather than through laws passed in this country.
David, it's a lot to go through, but you do it, and you do it quite succinctly in the book, Shall Not Be Infringed, The New Assaults on Your Second Amendment. Thanks, as always, for your time. We greatly appreciate it.
Anytime. My pleasure. Thank you.
David Keene, formerly chairman of the American Conservative Union and president of the National Rifle Association. He is now opinion editor at The Washington Times. And as we just mentioned, he is co-author of Shall Not Be Infringed, The New Assaults on Your Second Amendment. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.